Matthew chapter 24, we will be here, Lord willing, next week also. And we are looking at some of the signs of the return of Christ to earth. Let's read a passage, and then we'll see what inspired the question that the disciples asked, which led then Jesus to speak of these things that we're talking about today. In chapter 23 of Matthew, verse 37 says, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them that are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathers her chickens under her wings, and you would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate, for I say unto you, you shall not see me henceforth until you say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all these things? There's a question mark. He's saying, Do you really see these things? Verily, I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the age? And Jesus answered and said unto them, Take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. You shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for all of these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places. All of these are the beginning of sorrows. As this question is being asked and then answered by Christ, the background is Jesus saying to them, Your house is left unto you desolate, and henceforth you shall see me no more till you say, Blessed is he who cometh in the name of the Lord. And you have to understand, as they hear that, they are staggered by that statement. This house will be left desolate, speaking of the temple. The temple had been in construction for 40 years at this point in time. And every Jew in Israel in that day took it as a sign of God's blessing on their nation. Herod had been putting stones in place that are unimaginable. When you go to Israel today and you get down to the rabbi's tunnel, there's a stone there that's 45 foot long, 12 foot high in places, you know, the same width. They estimate over 700 tons cut to lay on the bedrock so the top is level and the ends are perpendicular. They have no idea how they put some of the stones that are there in place. Some of the stones are still down in the southern corner, 20 foot long, 18 foot long, 5 foot high, 8 foot thick, put in place without any mortar, fit together so well that it's hard to put the blade of a penknife between the stones, and I've done it. And it would be like someone saying to you and I, hey, look, there's the White House, there's the Capitol building, Washington Monument. Before you know it, all of this is going to be a pile of rubble. I mean, we would be shocked. And you have to understand, one of the dangers we stand in as Christians is that we've looked at these passages so many times. We've read Satan is alive and well on planet Earth and the late great planet Earth and all of the books. And we tend to say, oh, I know the book of Revelation. I know Daniel. I know Matthew 24. I know all these passages, 2 Thessalonians, the rapture of the church. And, you know, familiarity can breed contempt. And it isn't for you and I, in the days we live in, sufficient for it to be a mental exercise. These things are written to us by Jesus to bring a certain impact onto our lives and onto our hearts, to create a sense of expectation. And we stand in danger of being so familiar that we don't realize where we stand in light of these things. If someone said all that you take for granted that you find security in is going to be destroyed, that would be, as much as we think we know prophecy, that would be very hard for us to swallow. And as these disciples looked at the temple, they could hardly believe what he was saying. Herod said he wanted to build something that would outlast the pyramid, the great pyramid of Egypt. And this temple was limestone then overlaid with white marble imported and then gold. The front doors to the temple themselves were 80 foot high and they were overlaid with pure gold. Around the top of the temple, the pinnacles filled with spikes so that birds and pigeons couldn't land there and make the temple dirty. Pure gold, sparkling, all these spikes. There's a model there in Israel. You can see the way that it looked. The ancient rabbi said, if you looked at the temple in the sun, you had to close your eyes because of the white marble and the gold all around it. You couldn't look at it in the sun. It was too bright to look at. The Talmud says, if you haven't seen Herod's temple, and they hated the Romans, if you haven't seen Herod's temple, you've never seen a building. And for them to look at that, the center of their nation, and hear Jesus say, this is going to be desolate, they come to him and say, Lord, look at these things. Look at the buildings. And Luke tells us, they say, look at the great stones. Look at what's going on here. Then Jesus says to them, do you see these things? You don't see them. You think you see them. There's not one stone here that will not be thrown down. Not one stone will be left upon another. Do you see them? Because he saw them vastly different. He had come into Jerusalem on Palm Sunday weeping over the city because he knew what was coming. And it would be within 40 years that Titus Vespasian with the 5th, 10th, and 12th Roman legions would surround Jerusalem and settle in for a long siege. It lasted over a year. Within a year, mothers inside the city were eating their children. Cannibalism. They were throwing the diseased bodies over the wall outside the city so that the plague wouldn't spread inside the city. And Titus Vespasian, Josephus says, who was not a believer, threw his hands in the air and said, God, don't hold me accountable for this. The soldiers were incensed because the Jews refused to give up. Titus Vespasian called a meeting with some of the Jewish leaders and said to them, look, you've retreated to the temple. Don't make us force this issue. We'll have to destroy your temple. And Herod had been involved in building, and he said, don't make us do that. And the Jews refused to surrender. One night, a group of Roman soldiers found their way through the city without resistance and were shocked, came all the way to the temple wall itself. One soldier standing on the shoulders of another soldier threw a torch into the temple, and it began to burn because it was lined with cedar and there was wood inside. As that started to happen, such a commotion started that Titus Vespasian was awakened from his sleep, ran into the temple precincts with all the fervor. He started screaming, and the soldiers thought he was saying to burn the temple, and they started throwing torches in the windows, and the temple became an oven. It caught on fire. The wood inside burning and the limestone heating up. So hot that the gold on the doors to the temple melted and ran down. That the pinnacle of the temple with all the spikes began to melt, and all of the gold ran down and trickled between the stones. And finally, the city was destroyed. The Roman soldiers, because part of their pay, their salarium, the salary they got, was from any spoil they could take from the battle. Those Roman soldiers then, when the smoke had cleared and the battle was over, began to take pry bars, and hundreds of soldiers were flipping the stones off the wall down into the Kidron in the Cheesemaker's Valley. And they began to scrape the gold out that had run between the stones. And there wasn't one stone left upon another, just as Jesus had said. That's an important preface as we look at these other things, because what it tells us is the reason that Jesus sees things vastly different is he sees the future. He sees the beginning and the end of them. He sees the whole story. And what he was trying to say to his disciples then and what he's trying to say to us now is, I don't want you to look at life the way the unbeliever looks at life. I don't want you to look at things that surround you and think that you can find some security in them. I want you to see things vastly different than unbelieving men and women see them. Because this most sacred thing, this most stable thing in your life is about to be dismantled and taken down. And what if that's true with our lives and the things that are around us? That's an important preface, because what it means is he sees our day as clearly as he saw 40 years into the future. And he's given us great exhortations that we should be ready, that we should be aware, that we should be sober, that we should be vigilant. Now, where do we stand as we look at all of these things? Well, he begins to warn, first of all, of false prophets, false messiahs, false Christs, those coming saying that they, in fact, are the Christ. And, of course, the world is filled with those kinds of people. Even in Paul's day, there were false prophets. But Paul himself expected the Lord to come in his day. Paul, in 1 Corinthians 7, speaking to the married men, says, this is my opinion, and he would always preface it, not the word of God, but I think you single guys should stay single. Because if you get married, then you have to be worried about the concerns of your wife. If you stay single, you can be worried about the things of the Lord, and after all, he's coming very soon. Imagine if all the single men in the church would have listened to Paul. We'd have died in the first century. The church would be extinct. He was expecting the Lord's return. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, he says, then we which are alive, personal pronoun including himself, then we which are alive shall be caught up together with them in the air, so shall we ever be with the Lord. So shall we ever be with the Lord. He expected the Lord to come in his day. And today, the world is filled with people with all kinds of prophecies. You know, from Nostradamus to Edgar Cayce, they say on Hollywood Boulevard, there are 60 to 90 new messiahs a month that show up. Bob Coy told me several weeks ago in his church, as he was preaching, at the end of the service when he was inviting people to receive Christ, for some reason, he said, that night I decided to say, I want to introduce you to the Messiah. And he said, I said that over and over. And he said, people were coming. He said, I saw this one girl coming, thought she was coming to be saved. She walked up the steps and stood next to me at the pulpit. He said, now everybody's looking. And I said, can I help you? She said, well, yeah, I'm the Messiah. And I heard you tell the church several times now you want to introduce them to me. So I thought I better come up. And of course, the security people came and whisked the Messiah away. I remember 1970, in those days, somewhere in there, it's all a blur, that period. Harris and I see here this morning, we went to New York to receive knowledge from Guru Maharaji of the Divine Light Mission. He was a 14-year-old guru then, and he had divine light. We sat for 3 days, miserable, and then this little kid blew in our ears. And you walk away thinking, boy, I better act like I got something, because if I don't, I'm really stupid. Our suspicions were confirmed within a few years because Guru Maharaji, as he got a little older, became interested in women and started eating cheeseburgers and spending money on limousines and had all of these ladies in his life. And then his older brother back in India realized, well, the Lord of the universe should never act like that. It really should have been me. So they went to court and were trying to settle in court who was really the Lord of the universe. And by then I'm thinking, I can't believe I sat 3 days and let this little fat kid blow in my ear. Good thing I didn't give him any money. The world is filled with false Christ, false messiahs. And many have been saying for years, the Lord's coming, the Lord's coming, the Lord's coming. Your grandparents might say, oh, they said that in our day. Well, let me tell you something very important as we look at these things, wars, rumors of wars, famine, pestilence, earthquake, two things that set us aside from any generation that has ever lived, and that's why the last 2 weeks we looked at the rebirth of the nation of Israel. These prophecies anticipate the rebirth of the nation of Israel. Verse 15 says, when you see the desolation of abomination spoken of by Daniel the prophet, then let the reader understand. Then, verse 16, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in Judea. Judea is going to be a reality. The temple is going to be a reality. It tells us in this chapter to watch for the budding forth of the fig tree, the rebirth of the nation of Israel. That sets our generation aside. Israel is God's timepiece telling the world that we have come into a season that all the prophets have spoken of. The other thing that sets us aside, and I think is equally important, is nuclear proliferation. We are the first generation that has ever lived in the history of the world that stands in jeopardy of self-annihilation. We stand at the place now where we can destroy ourselves. Look in verse 22. Jesus said, except those days should be shortened, there should be no flesh saved. He said, if I wouldn't come when I did, there would be no human being, no animal, no flesh alive left on the planet Earth. See, that sets us aside. So if we look at these birth pains, that's the important word in verse 8. There's always been wars. There's always been famines. There's always been pestilence. Always been earthquakes. But when it says these are the beginning of sorrows, it isn't just that those things are terrible and will sadden the human heart. It is that these are the beginning of birth pains. I've been with my wife 4 times as she's given birth. I contributed. She did most of the work. I cheered her on. I was there thinking I'm glad I'm a man because I'm not man enough to go through that. Ah! And you know when you're in transition. This is no longer a psychological pregnancy. There's no way to back out of this. And they got the Holter monitor on and you're watching. And what's happening is the arrow's going, ooh, and she's going, ooh, and the contractions are getting more severe and closer together. That is indicating birth pains. So if we take the rebirth of the nation of Israel and you add to that wars, rumors of wars, famine, pestilence, earthquake, increasing in frequency and intensity all at the same time, now that constitutes the sign that the return of Jesus Christ is close at hand. And that's what we're watching for. Never before, not in the Crusades, where was the human race going to annihilate itself? Not in the Civil War. A lot of people died, but we weren't going to wipe the whole planet out. Neither in World War I. Even in World War II, wasn't until the end of the war that we saw Hiroshima and Nagasaki. World War II, 32 million were killed in battle on the battlefield. 25 million civilians were killed in bombing raids. 25 million civilians, estimated, died in concentration camps around the world. That's 82 million people dead, 29 million left wounded and maimed. Estimated cost to the Allies, $225,000 per kill. Now, we've become much more frugal. We found much less expensive ways to do that. We're finally saving money somewhere. We can kill cheaper. Because now one Trident sub carries 24 missiles. Each missile has 15 independently targeted warheads. Can destroy 360 sites, 360 cities, one sub. And the force of that power, one submarine, and I don't know how many we have now, one sub has 40 times the detonating power of every weapon detonated in World War II by every side, the Germans, the English, the French, the Americans, the Japanese, one single submarine, 40 times the force that left 82 million people dead, 40 times that, one sub. As of 1980, the Russians had 37,000 nuclear weapons. The United States estimated 1980 had 24,000 nuclear weapons. We've downscaled that. Today, presently, they estimate that the United States has a five-Earth arsenal. That means we can destroy every inch on the planet five times, in case we don't do it the first four times. The Russians have at least a four-Earth arsenal. Problem is, there are 12 other nations now that have nuclear weapons. There are 66 nations that are developing ICBMs and cruise missiles. They estimate there's between 16 and 19,000 nuclear devices unaccounted for from the former Soviet Union. Between 16 and 19,000. Doesn't that cheer you up? A couple years ago, this is 1995. I'm not sure where you're. I'm sorry. Yeah, 1995. Think back to 1995. Norway sent up, in conjunction with the United States, a satellite, weather satellite, on a missile to watch specifically the Northern Lights, but a weather satellite. Russia goes on red alert and says, this is a missile from an American Trident sub. Called the United States on the hotline. You just fired a missile from a Trident sub. No, we didn't. Yes, you did. No, we didn't. Yes, you did. That's all I know about the conversation. They have three briefcases that have to be opened in Russia to start a nuclear assault. Two of them were opened, put in place. The third one was brought to Yeltsin, opened up in front of him. First time ever, 1995, all three cases were opened. Where were you? Playing golf? Some of the military commanders were encouraging Yeltsin to hit the button. Because you only have a 20 to 25 minute window once those things go off to make up your mind whether they're real or not. And imagine, we don't know what kind of mood Yeltsin was in that day. You know, was he saying, I don't know whether I should hit the button or not. You know, I mean, here's your future, 1995. He's sitting in front of the red button. How close was that to all of us? Have an article here. This is last year, 1997, in Miami. Customs officials, set up a sting. They purchased a nuclear weapon from terrorists via Colombia to be detonated in the United States. Customs official acted like terrorists and purchased a nuclear weapon out of the Soviet Union through Colombia from terrorists to be detonated here. 1997. Now look, figure that today there are 90 nuclear weapons per day being produced. Am I cheering you up? 90 per day being produced. 40% of global spending is on weapons and military development. 50% of all scientists in the world work in some field of development of nuclear or military weaponry. Add to that the tensions between Afghanistan and Iran right now, Turkey and Syria right now, at a ready state of war, Turkey and Cyprus right now, Iraq now still developing weapons, the Balkans, Chechnya, the Serbs, the tension in Israel. This is not a good scene. Unless, you know, as you look at these things, how do you interpret them? That's the key to this. 8 weeks ago, this summer, staff meeting Monday morning, Judy interrupts. Normally she doesn't. She said, Pentagon's on the phone. I thought, oh, great, what do we do now? Get on the phone, Naval Commander. Hey, Pastor Joe, involved down here with 247 believers, 15 separate Bible studies. We listen to your tapes. We listen to Chuck Missler's updates. We listen to your tapes from Philadelphia. We're getting ready to start a series on the life of Christ, so we sent them all of Matthew, Mark, Luke, John down. Had an opportunity to go out to dinner with them, talk with them. He said, Pentagon morale's at an all-time low. Military's been gutted, trimmed down. I said, how prepared are we? He said, not very. Men that are good men, Christian men, they have a chapel every Wednesday morning, might have an opportunity to get down and do the chapel. 78 high-ranking officers that are all believers, demoralized by what's going on. Men that love the country. Said across the office from my office is the Y2K office. They're trying to get ready for the Y2K. Don't ask me what is Y2K. You should know what it means. Y year 2000. K is 1000. What will happen? Who knows? Is it going to be the end of Western civilization? I don't think so. I think that's crazy. You know, people going to the mountains storing guns and food, I think you're a kook if you're doing that. But it'll be something. What will it be? Who knows? How do we prepare? Well, we're not sure. We'll keep our eyes open. He said if we put everybody on it right now in the Defense Department, we'd be ready between 2004 and 2006. He said we'll have our major systems up by the year 2000. I called Chuck Smith. I said, Chuck, he's my pastor. He goes, when things like this happen, the whole world's changing. I need advice. Chuck, what are you guys doing? Are you preparing for Y2K? He said, yes. He said, I'm preparing. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm memorizing Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth be removed, though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. That's good preparation. Because you see, as we look at these things, this is not just a depressing list of information. Jesus said, these are the signs that tell you that I'm about to return and take my bride to heaven. That's what all of that is. And that's what we're looking at. If I was just an unbeliever and I was informed, I would live depressed. If I had to depend on CNN to find out what was going on in the world, I would be depressed. The beauty about it is I can get up in the morning and, you know, in Paul's day they couldn't do that. I can flick on the news and see if we're still here. What happened while I was asleep? Did the world blow up? You know, we don't have any excuse. We are able to bring into our panorama all of the things that Jesus told us about. And they're in front of us. For you and I as believers, the impact of this should be, Romans chapter 13 tells us that we should be preparing our hearts, knowing that the time, that now it is high time to awake out of sleep, for now is our salvation nearer than we believe. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness. So as you read through that list, it says for you and I as believers that the coming of the Lord should have an impact on our lives today, not just our hope, but our present lifestyle. That any man who has this hope purifies himself even as he is pure. Good way to challenge ourselves. Do we believe that Jesus is really coming? That we believe that he could come at any moment? If we do, are we living in sexual sin? Are we saying, Lord, don't come till I get the liquor out of the house or the pornography? Lord, don't come till my wife's black eye goes away, or if she's tougher than you are, until my black eye goes away? Or are we living in such a way where, as Jesus says, we can lift up our heads because our redemption is drawing nigh? Examine your life. Take inventory. It says in Hebrews that we should be considering one another to provoke one another to love and good works, not neglecting the gathering together of ourselves, as is the habit of some, and especially all the more as we see the day drawing near. It says in regards to other believers that we should take ownership, that you look at this church and you look at the people and the children are here, you should have a sense of ownership, caring about those people and exhorting them and stirring them up to love and good works, and not neglecting the gathering together of yourselves, but stirring one another up, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. It's to have an impact on our lives. Because what we believe is that the bridegroom is coming for the bride. I am not preparing for Y2K. When I listen to Chuck, I realize we should be preparing for Y2R. Yeshua to the rescue. That's what we're waiting for. If you're here today and you don't know Christ personally, the question is, are you ready to face this? Are you ready to face the things that are coming on the world? There is a way that we can do that with hope. But if you're not sure, if you died today, where you would spend eternity, you don't have very much hope. If I just looked at these things and was an informed human being and did not believe in eternity and life beyond the grave, I would be very, very troubled. I might consider moving to the mountains and storing guns and food. But if you could survive what God's bringing on the world with brown rice, he would not be very impressive to me. What he's bringing on the world will turn this world upside down and hopefully see millions turn to him. That's the hard way. That is the hard way.